Hi everyone, it's great to be here today and thanks so much for coming. Well, after hearing from Manal and Robert and Veva, you all know about a lot of the efforts that are going on to make joint use happen in more locations. And what I'm going to be doing today is telling you about a website called jointuse.org that really acts as a kind of hub for those efforts. And first I'm going to be telling you about why we created the website, and then I'll show you some of its main features, and finally point you to some resources that you can use to create a web presence for other public health issues. I should also mention that while the site is focused on California, that a lot of the resources do apply nationwide. So first, formality here, I have no relationships to disclose. Also, some housekeeping notes. Unfortunately, as you may already know, there's no internet in this room, so I can't really give you a full guided tour of the website. Instead, I'm limited to showing you screen captures, but if you do have smartphones with you, please feel free to get those out and follow along. One quick caveat, though, the site does have a couple of features that were created in Flash, and if you are using an iPhone, like I am, unfortunately those won't load properly, but that's just a couple of features. Everything else on the site should work just fine. Okay, so why create a website about joint use? There are already hundreds of joint use partnerships going on just in California alone, lots of advocacy work happening around the issue, and before we launched the website in 2009, there were already lots of resources about it. But the trouble was that they were scattered all over the place. The advocacy efforts were scattered across the state, and the resources were all over the web. So essentially, what you had all of these different spokes, but no kind of center hub to hold them together and allow them to move and operate as a unit. And creating the task force itself was a really big step in that direction. It just wasn't quite enough. And the task force knew that if they really wanted to create a movement and further their policy goals, they had to take all the people working on joint use and get them working on it together. They also knew that they needed broad support for the issue, not just among public health types, but among others in different professions too, and so that's where the website really comes in. And I think that jointuse.org helps the task force move, create this movement by doing three things. First, it raises the visibility of joint use. It also pools the resources on the issue and puts it in one location to make them easier to find. And then finally, it helps connect people to one another. So this website, it's this online space where people can get together, brainstorm ideas, and really solidify their policy priorities. We also thought that creating the website made a lot of sense from a social justice perspective because it allows us to deliver free content to people in a location where they're already overwhelmingly active. In fact, 77% of Americans are now online, and you can see there that that is up from 44% just a decade ago. So that's a huge jump, and it's just going to keep growing. Now, that being said, I'm not trying to suggest that if you build a website that people will automatically flock to it. But I do think it's safe to say we're at the point where people have come to expect a lot of information to be online. And I'll use myself as an example here. Let's say a new restaurant opens in town and I want to look up the menu, see what's on their menu before I go. Well, if I Google them and I can't find a website for them, I'm frustrated, and honestly, it kind of seems like they don't even exist if they're not on the web. Now, I know that joint use is a public health issue and it's not a business, but whether we're talking about where to find your next meal or something like figuring out how to open up a school's gym after hours to the community, it's still really important to have a web presence. And that presence can be particularly effective, and this is something I really want to stress, It can be very effective when it's used as part of a larger communications strategy. So creating the website shouldn't replace offline efforts. Instead, it should support and reinforce those efforts. And that's exactly what the website does for the task force. It's just a part of their efforts. For example, one thing that the task force is working to do is create more visibility among the trade press and get articles placed in the trade press. And we've recently had a couple of those placed in California Schools Magazine and a research journal called Health Education and Behavior. And so then we've used the website to cross-promote those. But again, it was not a substitute for getting those articles published in the first place. Okay, so enough of me talking about the website. Let's actually see it. So here we have the homepage, and what we wanted to do here was establish the tone for the site and to frame joint use as something that is fun, something that can improve health, and something that is possible. So we get at those themes with just a few really short, basic questions in this. If you were on the internet, you would see that it's a photo slideshow. So I'll just read you these questions. What makes us healthy? What makes it hard for us to be healthy? Who decides if we have places to walk or play? We can go from this empty lot to this, kids having fun playing. Joint use, join us. And we end there by inviting people to sign up for the newsletter and also just generally inviting them into the joint use community. Now, another aspect of the site that was really important is the language itself. And we wanted to make a point to keep the language very simple, plain, straightforward, and as jargon-free as possible, because again, this website is for multiple audiences, not just people in public health. And we wanted to make sure that when people not familiar with the issue come to the site, that they don't feel alienated or intimidated by some of the language. And I think probably the best example of that is this related research page. And you can see that we're boiling down some fairly complicated research and just putting it in plain language. You can see these headlines, kids gain weight faster during the summer than during the school year. So again, very basic there. So this resource and others, a lot of them are located under the very cleverly named resources tab there. Since I don't have time to go through the whole site, I'm just going to give you kind of an overview and then highlight a couple of my favorites. So we have information about the task force, a link to the toolkit that Robert was telling you about. There are, if you see under resources, see the problem, that's where the photo voice projects are located. We have four of them in English, four of them in Spanish. There are also quite a few tools for advocates, including a fact sheet and some sample letters to the editor. Let's see, we have a discussion board. There's a section for reporters and also some social networking links. And probably my favorite resource is this joint use locator. It's a mapping tool that allows people to type in their city or their zip code, and it pulls up a list of joint use partnerships that are in your area. And one of the nicest things about it is that in addition to getting a description of the partnership, for most of these locations, you can also view and print the actual legal, the formal legal agreement itself. And my other favorite is this success spotlight. And here we have videos from several locations in California where the community has implemented joint use and been very happy with the results. So I think we're good on time. I'm going to play one of the videos for you from Pixley, California, which is in the Central Valley, about an hour north of Bakersfield. And this will take just a moment to load. There we go.
70 miles south of Fresno. Population, 3,000. It's not surprising that this small town has only one school. But what's offered after school, well, that should get your attention.
Okay, chicas, vamos a ensayar el sonido. Pixley School is home to a flourishing ballet folklorico troupe run by parent volunteers. But the Ballet Folklorico started out in a far more humble space. The group originally practiced here, on this broken-down basketball court. Teresa Garcia and Trini Herrera are among the troupe's founders.
It's very difficult because there's a lot of cracks in the concrete, and sometimes the children fall or we can't hit the steps right because of the concrete being broken up.
And then there's the Central Valley heat, easily reaching 100 degrees or more in the summer.
It's very difficult because it's very hot, and we could only practice for 3 minutes at a time because we had to give the kids a break because they need water.
The Ballet Folklorico needed a new home, and the school had a facility. Both parties were enthusiastic about teaming up and creating a joint-use partnership.
We have an after-school program, and we are trying to expand and enrich our program, so we decided to partnership with them.
One of the benefits was getting out of the heat, but also being able to expand the group. Here we didn't have a lot of children, and in the after-school program, obviously the number has increased.
The cultural benefits are obvious, but the superintendent saw potential for big health benefits as well.
We are really interested in prevention of obesity, especially with our youngsters, and with type 2 diabetes being on a rise for our children. It really gives them another avenue to get involved in physical activity without actually having to go out to play sports.
It's a tremendous activity and a tremendous exercise for them. And if you're moving your body, you're burning calories and you're making your body stronger inside and out.
Whatever the benefits, the kids love it.
I like it a lot because it makes me feel confident with myself.
It's fun and I enjoy it, and I like presenting in front of people.
And one more benefit, better academic performance.
I noticed that children tend to be happier. We have a reduction in expulsions, suspensions. So it does have benefits.
The Pixley School embrace of joint use extends outside the school buildings to the surrounding green space. It's open to the public after school and on weekends. And while some school districts worry about vandalism if the green space is open, Sadie Nishitani has seen just the opposite.
We feel that by opening it up, by becoming more accessible to our community members who use and value the access to the green space, they develop pride and ownership.
So it just adds to that whole attitude of this is ours, so we got to take care of it. It's a win-win again for this whole philosophy and attitude of sharing resources between each other.
Okay, and if you view those videos on the website itself, the audio actually is synced up, so not sure why that happened. But, okay, well, you can tell that the website has a lot of resources on it, and if I could brag for just a moment, it did actually win an award last year for excellence in new communications from the Society for New Communications Research. So now the question is, how did we do all of this on a nonprofit budget? And here is a list of a lot of the tools that made that possible. So I'm just going to run through these, starting at the top with WordPress. That's what we used for the site's content management system, and it is free, although that does kind of have a reputation as being a blogging platform. It is fully customizable and can be a robust content management system, so I highly recommend using that. It's easy to install and also very user-friendly. For hosting the website, we used Bluehost, only $7 a month. The Joint Use Locator, that's a customized embedded Google map, also free. BB Press is what runs the discussion board. That's a sister site of WordPress, and that's free as well. Then, of course, the social networking sites are all free. Now, SoundSlides Plus, that's the most expensive one on the list, but it's still only $60 for a license. And that is the software that we use to put together, we kind of repackage the photo slideshows, the photo voice slideshows for the website. And I just think that the interface is a lot easier to use than some of the higher priced ones like Slideshow Pro. So highly recommend that. Then for photo editing, for those of you who don't have Photoshop or maybe have it on your computer but don't know how to use it, Picnic is a very user-friendly program. It's free online. It's great for basic editing like cropping and color correcting. They do also have a premium version for $25, but just for basic editing, I don't think that's necessary. Then finally, JCut. Now that's something that we didn't use. We didn't use JCut for jointuse.org, but I've heard really great things about it. It's for video editing, and it's free. And the other benefit besides it being free is you don't have to download anything onto your computer. It's an online program, so you don't have to worry about Mac PC compatibility, and it also allows you to have multiple people working on the same project and editing from different computers in different locations, so that makes it very convenient. And if anybody wants more information about any of those resources or additional resources, you can ask me during the Q&A, which is about to start, or after this session is over. Thank you.
To invite all the speakers up and to open it up to the audience for questions, comments, ideas, suggestions that you have for our fabulous panel here. So I'm going to open it up, ask you to speak loudly, ask the panel to also speak loudly because you're not mic'd, but hopefully we'll be able to hear everything. So questions? Comments?
So I think Robert, you also spoke to the fact of community mobilization, community outreach being really important. I'm sure that's important in a number of ways, bringing voices to local policy leaders, school board officials, or whatever. How is that process working? Is that done through programs like PIAC and CROP, or you know, are people just going to take up this on their own, or I'm just certainly interested to hear stories about that.
Can you summarize the question real quickly so the audience can hear? So I think your question is sort of the mobilization of community to support joint use, kind of where that starts.
That's right.
Okay. So with us, before we even engaged in Photo Voice Project, we were doing interventions around obesity prevention. And the community members across, you know, these eight counties were all sort of pointing to the fact that their children didn't have safe places to play. That wasn't really documented anywhere. And in order for you to get decision makers to recognize a problem, you have to show them, you know, they have to prove there's a problem for them. And so the Photo Voice piece was fantastic in that way, because when we did the community events, they not only were hearing, seeing the kids who took it, but then the community members that came were also voicing like, yes, that is an issue, we really need to address it. So it is a way of advocacy. Engaging youth is also a way of mobilizing them to be sort of advocates and involved in it. And it can also serve as sort of an evaluation, because some of our Photo Voice pieces were before and afters. So then you could show evidence to an elected official or decision maker, like, you did it and here's the change. So that last success story that I told you in Fresno, where they've unlocked the gate, they've gone and to take pictures of all the families now that are recreating and exercising there. And so it's the evidence that, you know, we unlocked the gate, and what we expected to happen did happen. More people were utilizing it, and they're being physically active.
So I've seen examples where community mobilization and community demand for access to school facilities after hours has just happened spontaneously. You have engaged people in the PTA, or in the Rotary Club, or in the Lions around the state of California, frankly. I don't know how it works in your state, but in California, school funding comes from the state to the school district. And it's very low amount. We're 47 out of 50 states and districts of Columbia in the amount we spend per child on schools. And the reaction has been that lots of school districts are creating educational foundations where they raise money separately to benefit the schools. And in those places, a lot of them have cottoned on to the fact that, okay, we're raising money separately here and giving it to you all for X, Y, and Z. We want to have access after hours. So you see a lot of that going on. My sense, and this isn't supported by any research, is that in the lower income communities where they don't have that sort of thing, organizations like ours or others are often more necessary for sort of pushing that community mobilization forward. That's certainly one of the things we're trying to do. And I think jointuse.org is a great tool. And I love that joint use locator. One of the best ways to move a skeptical school board or a skeptical board of supervisors forward is to show them that the community next door is doing it. And these guys can do it. What's the matter with you? And I love that sort of competition. Oh, well, if they can do it in Fresno, we can do it better here. That kind of thing. And so I think that's one of the things that I try to do as much as possible.
I have a question. somewhere in the presentation, the issue of enforcement came up, and I was curious to hear a little bit more about that. So if a joint use agreement is made, what are the issues of enforcement? How does enforcement take place, and what are the ramifications of that or backlash?
Is that to me?
It can, whoever is appropriate.
I mean, enforcement comes in a number of ways, right? Making sure that the school gate actually does get open. That doesn't happen all the time. You sometimes have agreements at the district level, and the individual principal was not brought in to the discussion, and the superintendent doesn't have time to go around and find out if this principal is making sure that his or her. So, enforcement comes through relationship building and through expectations and keeping those current. I also have seen there's a sort of a meta level for enforcement where joint use agreements often lapse. And the way to guard against that is to build in a process whereby the agreement is revisited every 2, 3, 5 years so that as new people come on board, they get an opportunity to see what's working for them and what's not working for them and have it be a living document that is continually updated. And that gives people opportunity to buy in and to make sure the document is written for them. With all of that said, I think there's no silver bullet. And back to the community demand and making sure that this is something that stays on the front burner and that there's a real demand and want for this in the community is the best way to make sure that this stays a reality and not just an agreement.
Just curious about, we have a hard time in Ohio, probably everywhere, getting support for school levies and things like that. Has there been any kind of study done about, this seems like it could be a win-win situation, that schools become community centers, they become more popular, people that don't have children in schools might be able to use facilities and gain access. So is there a direct effect coming that in terms of support for schools out of this that you've seen or that you're aware of?
I've seen any studies.
I think one of the things that we've seen is for both in California, both park bonds and school bonds, which have very high, overwhelming support among low-income voters, Latino voters, and African-American voters, which is interesting because they, as a portion of their income, the part that they commit to that, but we think that has to do very high. And we think that, and probably in the last several months, is the reason they have passed, or, you know, and so I think we think that part of the reason has to do because they see the value in it. It will make extreme, you know, benefit for them. And so in particular with joint use, I mean, the context in which we're trying to get joint use happening is in communities where overall park access is far below, you know, acreage to per capita, far below other places. So I think, you know, that's a small piece of what you're saying. A lot of what we know about the win-win comes from individual places saying we've done it and we love it, or it's rooted in a philosophy that we have as a district and we wouldn't have it any other way. We don't want to go back. It's about relationship building and maintaining that. So we had some speakers from, you know, a city and a school board member from Paramount. I mean, they like looked like they were brother and sister. They've been working for 40 years together and whatever, and they're totally committed. And from them, the win-win is just, you know, it's what we do. We needed to provide these, you know, so I think there are lots of places that have found kind of a good solution. And the happy medium, and a lot of times, I mean, where we've seen it, a couple of good examples that Robert and I have really, you know, seen in talking to some of the folks that are doing it is when the land space is limited for a district or it's a small city and things are compact and they, like, if we're gonna meet the needs of our residents for activity, for recreation, we need to do this, and, you know, and even if the, you know, so that's one of the places I think, but I don't know if I'm fully getting to your question.
So I've not seen any research that shows that the support for school bonds increases in community X after they move from no joint use agreement to joint use agreement. I think that's what you're asking, right? I've heard lots of anecdotal stuff that would indicate that yes, it does. If you could maybe in your car, I don't know, look around for that research. I mean, I don't know what's the threshold for the passage of a school bond in Ohio, but in California it's 2/3. And what Manal said is true. In lower income and minorities who have kids and their kids are in the elementary school district or in the public schools tend to support these things more. The big problem that we have in a lot of communities in California is with the older and white couples and white households who do not have kids anymore, kids have grown up and moved away, and don't see this as something that is of interest to them. And that, I think, is the real demographic we need to hit. We've been talking about childhood obesity today, but for the seniors to be able to have somewhere close to home where they can go in the evenings and walk around the track or whatever they feel safe is critical. And so that's why I've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence that demographic starts to understand, hey, this is a community school, it's not just for the kids, it's for me as well, and that they will support it, but I've not seen the research. But it just makes sense. I'll look for the research and if you give me your contact information, I'll try to find you. I don't know, we've got someone here from the state government, I don't want to put him on the spot, but have you guys seen any evidence around the state that support for bond measures goes up with joint use in place?
We get a lot of our joint use information from all of you.
Thank you.
In fact, actually, I was going to follow up with a question. As we've worked together over the past year, especially with joint use issues, and as we try to move this forward into the transition of the new administration in California, is there research about economic benefits to communities or economic outcomes where they've been quantified or cost savings associated with doing joint use? I'm sure there are more with new projects, but I'm even talking about just the economic benefit, because that really sells so many people on things like joint use that make sense in our minds and say it.
So Peter, I mean, for an individual facility, so let's take that Fairmead school.
Yeah.
It's gonna cost more to operate that individual facility if it's open to the community through joint use, because instead of the facility being used 8 hours a day, it's going to be, say, 12 hours a day, so there's going to be more wear and tear. So that's just a fact, so it'll cost more for that. My sense is that for the whole district, however, instead of having to have two facilities, they could have one. Well, to be fair, Fairmead wasn't going to have two facilities anyhow. But in those places where they were potentially going to have a park and rec facility and a school facility, you will just have one now, and so that will cost less. The Center for Cities and Schools in Berkeley has done their, what's it called, the joint use estimator, and where they can figure out what the increased cost might be for the individual site. I have not seen anyone, and maybe I stand corrected, do one where they look at the whole district and think hypothetically how much a district might save by combining, but I bet you we can dig that up. I mean, if you go to Fontana, where the Fontana Unified School District in the city built those facilities across the street from each other and agreed to share, I'm 100% certain that they did the math to figure out how much it would cost if they didn't do that, and how much it cost and how much they saved by doing it. So you should be able to do that.
Yeah, I think that's beneficial information to share. In addition to the legal challenges, and I do, yeah, with individual sites, that's going to be a cost, but I think when you look at the benefit as a whole, as you mentioned, the Fontana district, when you're able to quantify the benefit as well, there may be an individual cost here, but the cost benefit, you know, spread over.
And it's not just rec facilities, it can be for libraries, it can be, so
right,
joint
right.
Use can be for many other facilities. Yeah.
And I think probably we need to do a better job extrapolating out and saying joint use is a way to get at a norms change, that we are trying to create better use of mixed use, compact development, all the things that we think are the right way to improve communities. Joint use is one of the tools in the toolbox, but when you're able to grow and develop in a way, schools already, many need to be retrofitted, you know, that are old facilities. And, you know, and so we need to realign those incentives, I think, so that it works. And then we also know that if we can attract the concentration of mixed uses into places that people, you know, all the stuff, you know, that people will have to drive less, people will have more time in their communities, it attracts businesses. And so I kind of feel like we've got to connect all those dots a little bit better. And I know it's not helpful in the policy, you know, sense when we're trying to get one thing passed, but at the same time, I do see a real value in saying we're really trying to create a shift in the way that we use our public resources. And one of the things that feels really important to me with the joint use is that these school facilities are public spaces. They, as I understand them, they're all paid for from the ground up by our public dollars, just like the streets is the largest public space that we have. And we, I do think, have a need to empower ourselves and step into that role and say the district and government is the stewards of that land. And if we don't feel like it's meeting our needs as we grow, as we become more diverse, as demographic shifts happen, then I think we need to say, you know, there is a right that we have to reassess, update, and examine how we're using those facilities, our streets, our playgrounds, our school grounds, and really kind of step up our game in terms of that, because I think we have been betting for too long on a system that just quite frankly is not giving us the physical activity resources that we need across the board.
I think there's, yeah.
I just had a question about the maintenance issue, and I was just recently with a community coalition that's looking at all these different issues, and they were saying, and somebody piped up from, I think, the community college and said, you know, what we really need is a track facility and ability to, you know, and then I find out that the high school has this beautiful track facility, but it's not open to anybody else because it's a beautiful track facility.
It's stadium.
And they want it to stay beautiful.
Right. And so, and the sort of the overwhelming reaction was, oh, well, they'll never, you know, that'll never happen.
Come at them with money. In Burlingame, which is just south of San Francisco, a big issue, and I hate this, I grew up in Canada and I was stunned when I moved to California to find that the places were ripping up their natural grass fields because the wear and tear, it's hard to maintain them, and they were putting in turf fields so that you could use it 24/7. And they did that in Burlingame, and they got the money, and so the high school built it, and the AYSO, the American Youth Soccer Organization, has a 5-year joint use agreement with them where they're paying for the field. And AYSO gets the field for a certain number of hours a week. And the rest of the time, it's for the community and for the school. And the fact that AYSO was able to come in with the money meant that they could have access to this sort of thing. And I've seen many others where it's a community college district, has a joint use agreement with a high school district and whatever. And you can come in with money, and it's going to be much less money than it would take to build it yourself, and say, here, we can pay for the maintenance, that unlocks a lot of the gates. And there are joint use agreements that are strictly about that, and they outline how much you pay, and you know, the depreciation over the years, and that kind of stuff, and who's in charge during this hour, and who's in charge during that hour. I've seen places where they do handovers. Okay, it's going over, it's 6 o'clock, we're handing over from the school district to Parks and Rec, and they walk around the facility as if they were walking around a rental car, checking off what the condition is of the boys' bathroom, of the girls' bathroom, of the drinking fountain, of the exterior, and then they do the handoff again a couple hours later, and they, you know, work all that out, it's all in there.
In terms of fundraising, I think there's also in California, we can, the bond is usually to pay for the bricks and mortar and, you know, the actual building, but the operations and maintenance, I think we can use things like developers' fees and benefit assessment district. So levy, benefit assessment district will be levying a specific fee in California. This is our, you know, infinite wisdom for the mechanism to how to do this, but it's, you know, the people that own property in a place can vote to tax themselves on a sales tax or whatever, and then that can be used for operations and maintenance. Developer fees could be for, you know, new developments coming into a place. A certain amount of money can be, you know, pulled off the top and then used in different ways, and that has to be written out again in policy for how that gets distributed out to different communities. Usually it can't be for a specific facility, but has to be for, you know, it'll be, you know, doled out by some formula. And in LA County, they call those Quimby fees. And right now they're looking at how to do that so that there can be, you know, equitable distribution of those operations and maintenance fees in a way that can really support and rather than reinforce inequities, because what they were finding was people are more likely to develop in the affluent, say Santa Monica or Beverly Hills, and so they get the Quimby fees there, the developer fees there, and then in the law it said, and those developer fees have to be used within X miles of that development, and so it reinforced an inequity both in development and maintenance, because here in low income so-and-so, South LA, whatever, there's less attraction for developing and then less Quimby fees, and then all of a sudden you're maintaining that. So there's some mechanisms for the operations and maintenance, but that is definitely a tough place. The other thing that I'm very interested in is that there are a number of more affluent schools in more affluent school district that set up these friends of things. And organizations basically that are not the PTA that can basically be like the parents, you know, doing fundraising, blah, blah, and to support the, you know, that's going to be, so that's something I'm interested in, kind of looking and seeing how can we translate that into more low-income communities, and how can, it doesn't have to be monetary, but in-kind support for the operations and maintenance, things like trash pickup, being eyes there so that there's less vandalism, and that kind of stuff seem like a very important added value, difficult to quantify yet, you know, super important for the maintenance.
All right, so we are just about out of time, and I just want to thank the panel for your thought-provoking discussion and the audience for taking part. Also, before you leave, I want to remind you that the panel members do have materials if you want to pick them up. They're up here on the chairs, and they'll be available up here for a few minutes if you want to come ask more questions. And let's give them one more hand.
Oh. And one more thing. In my haste, I forgot to acknowledge Robin being here. She's a member of the and I just want, if you have questions for her on her way out, then you can probably catch her. So I'm sorry that I didn't mention in the context of my remarks, but she's been a very valuable contributor to that work as well.
Okay, let's give them one more hand. Thank you.